Once you get a reduced mucus layer, your immune system starts recognizing these microbes, not necessarily just PCS positive E. coli, but other microbes and their metabolites they produce, and they start an inflammatory reaction. And we can see that just once you reduce a mucus layer, regardless of whether the mice have this microbe or not, you start seeing inflammation in the gut. And that inflammation leads to secretion of nitric oxide, which PCS positive E. coli uses to breathe, right?
Yeah.
And then it blooms, right? So it's a kind of a vicious circle, you're right.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast from ISAP. We're a nonprofit scientific organization advancing science in probiotics, prebiotics, and related fields. This episode is part of our series exploring gut microbiota and colorectal cancer. We'll be speaking with experts about how microbes in the human gut contribute to colorectal cancer development and how this research is driving advances in diagnosis and treatment.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest is Alberto Martin from the Department of Immunology in the University of Toronto. So, Alberto, thank you so much for joining us. I know next to nothing about immunology, so you're going to have to help me a lot here. And I know your interests include, you know, how the immune system raises antibodies, how we detect things and react against them. Why is it if I take a probiotic, which is a microbe I've never encountered before in high numbers, I was going to say, why is it I don't raise antibodies against it? But maybe you're going to tell me I would raise antibodies against it. How do I recognize good from bad as the immune system?
Yeah, and that's a good question relating to the gut. There, you can raise antibodies against specific members of the gut microbiota. These tend to be more like pathogens or pathobionts, but generally the immune system is naive to what is in the gut because it's all essentially foreign, like all the microbes that, you know, we have trillions of bacteria in our gut and viruses. And so we generally are naive to that because it would be, I mean, we work along with these microbes that exist in our gut. And so we don't want to really mount an immune response against them it might damage them, but we do mount some immunity to some pathogens in the gut.
So they have to breach some kind of barrier. Do they get through the mucus layer or something like that to trigger a response?
Yeah, that might be the case. I mean, I think this is still an area in active investigation as to why we target some microbes, not others. But generally, that's the idea, is that these certain microbes might breach the barrier. And then there is a huge underlying, a lot of immune cells that line the gut that are poised and ready to act if necessary. But generally speaking, a lot of these immune systems, when you are healthy, a lot of this immune system does not necessarily see the bacteria that's in our gut because it's kind of separated by a physical barrier.
And so as an immunologist then, why are you interested in gut microbiota? It seems like it's blind to it and it ignores it. What's the link?
Well, yeah. Okay. So I'm in the Department of Immunology. I should say that while I am an immunologist, I'm also, this research is not necessarily immunology. It bridges a lot of different areas like microbiology, cancer. Cancer can sometimes interact with the immune system. Because I'm not necessarily an immunologist, I really follow what science interests me. And so I've been exploring these novel areas of research. You know, my background is on how antibodies are made. And I should classify myself as a geneticist. Because a lot of these, how antibodies are made requires a lot of DNA damage and repair to make antibody genes. And that's where my background comes in. And I've been interested in how DNA damage, DNA repair plays out in other systems. And so cancer is one major area, right, where DNA damage and DNA repair, a lot of DNA repair pathways are mutated in cancer. Colon cancer being one of them, where mismatch repair is frequently mutated in colon cancer patients. And so that's an area of expertise that I have. So that's kind of what drew me into the field. And my other area of interest, again, as I said, is DNA damage and DNA repair. And that's one reason what drew me interest into this microbe called PCS positive E. coli that secretes a toxin that can cause DNA damage.
And that actually is, Colin, I thought one of the things you might ask is, what is the advantage of that colobactin toxin that these particular E. coli seem to play a major role in increasing colorectal cancer risk? Like, what does that colobactin do to the benefit of the pathobiont?
Yeah. That's a really good question. You know, so when you think about our gut, right, and the microbes that exist in the gut, you know that there's trillions of them, and they're really fighting for space, right? They need elbows to fight for space for the nutrients, limited nutrients that exist there. And so a lot of these microbes, we're starting to learn, actually secrete toxins, not to cause cancer. There's no benefit for them to cause cancer, but they secrete toxins to deal with other microbes, right? So in this case, Colibacterium is a genotoxin that damages DNA, presumably of other microbes, right? And these other microbes, those microbes that don't have the right DNA repair pathways to repair the damage produced by Colibacterium, they presumably succumb to this DNA damage. So I think that's the reason why this specific microbe has this toxin, but other microbes have these undisclosed toxins. I mean, there was a paper published a number of years ago that showed that if you just look at, you know, isolates, bacterial isolates from IBD patients or inflammatory bowel disease patients. So I think they looked at 100 different microbes. They found like a good proportion of them produced this uncharacterized DNA damaging agent. And I can't remember the exact percentage, but maybe 30% of these bacteria produce something, a toxin, some sort of toxin that they haven't isolated yet that causes DNA damage. Right. So I think this is a general property of microbes. You know, they need elbows to make some space in the gut. And I think that that's where Colibacterium fits in.
So this particular bacteria, it seems to work its harm through the fact that it increases DNA damage. And so a person that's not equipped to deal with that is more vulnerable to cancer. Can you talk a little bit more about two other factors, the role of the mucosal barrier and how when that's impaired, that increases the risk, and also how diet kind of amplifies the risk.
Right. So, yeah. So that's, I think, probably our study and now emerging from many other labs is the importance of the mucus barrier, right? So we have a mucus barrier between our colon epithelial cells and the bacteria or the gut contents, you know, and this mucus layer is really important to keep nice and healthy and thick, right? And that's what basically disallows these microbes. They can't penetrate this mucus layer. So most microbes basically remain on the other side of this mucus layer. And that's one reason why our immune system don't see these microbes, because there's that separation, right? It's when you breach these mucus layers when you cause problems. And that's what our study showed, is that when you have and this was actually shown by Eric Martens in the States, that if you eat a low fiber diet, you reduce this mucus layer. And so we showed that that is what we see as well. When you eat a low fiber diet, you reduce this mucus layer. And this allows this microbe called PKS positive E. coli, the one that secretes the Colibacterium toxin, this allows this microbe to come into close proximity to the colon epithelial cells and then secrete its toxin and damage the DNA. All right. So that's one of the reasons why you want to have a nice, healthy mucus layer. And one of the reasons, you know, so as I said, a low fiber diet is one mechanism that can lead to a reduction in this mucus layer. And the mechanism behind that is thought to be, once you reduce fiber in your diet, you enhance this microbe, Verruca microbia, that are mucolytic bacteria. So these microbes then start eating the mucus layer and thinning in the mucus layer. And that, I think, is what causes all these other problems.
So we do a lot of work on bacteria, trying to compete in those spaces by producing bactericins, agents which produced by one bacterium kills other bacteria, usually by doing something like de-energizing the cell membrane or something, or forming pores in the cell membrane. Causing DNA damage seems like a really radical mechanism. It's like setting off a little bomb almost, because it affects, I mean, everything. Types of viruses is DNA based. And so as a strategy, how do you think something like that would have evolved?
It's strange, right? It's a good question and an answer I don't have, because, for example, when it secretes this toxin, it's presumably also damaging its own DNA, right? Mm-hmm. So it's it's an excellent question. Why would such a mechanism evolve? You know, I think where it lies is the DNA repair pathway. So one of our questions that we kind of semi-solved in that paper was, you know, what DNA repair pathway is responsible for repairing lesions produced by Colibacterium? And so we actually stumbled upon the mismatch repair pathway. That's the one that I mentioned to you before. It's a DNA repair pathway that repairs DNA mismatches in DNA. And that DNA repair pathway is actually frequently mutated in colon cancer patients. Well, bacteria also have mismatch repair, right? So they have, you know, what's called a mute-S homologs. I forgot the specific names, but these bacteria also have mismatch repair that can detect DNA mismatches that generally accumulate during DNA replication, but that can be caused by toxins. So I guess the idea is that maybe this PKS positive E. coli that produces this colibactin, you know, they might have not only the correct DNA repair pathways that can deal with its lesions produced by colibactin, but I think they also have other defense mechanisms that prevent colibactin from acting on its own DNA.
Yeah, we also know, of course, that DNA damage and repair and mutations is the very bedrock of evolution. Is there any evidence that cells that cause DNA damage to themselves and to others promote evolutionary processes? Or
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I can imagine, evolution is driven by, you know, mutations, essentially. And I can imagine that there might be some hyperevolution caused by this toxin. I just don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating to someone to look into that.
Yeah.
It's interesting that colibactin is also produced by some of the E. coli that are found in certain probiotic products and treat other intestinal disorders. And your work spans a lot of different intestinal diseases.
Yeah. You know, a very popular probiotic is called Nissl 1917, right? I don't know enough about how this probiotic is used, but I know it's been used for a while. It was first isolated in 1917, but it's used as a probiotic to improve, let's say, gut health. This microbe does have this PKS island. So PKS stands for polyketide synthase island, this island of genes that synthesize a toxin called colibactin. And this microbe does produce colibactin too, right? So one would think that this microbe might not be necessarily the best probiotic if it's capable of producing this toxin. Now, some papers have suggested that the toxin produced by this microbe is not as toxic as that produced by the PKS positive E. coli strain that we're talking about. And it's not clear why that is the case. Some suggest maybe that there's less of this toxin produced or it's not secreted in the proper fashion. But our preliminary data suggests that this microbe, and this is unpublished data, and it's a work we're doing in collaboration with a group in France, is that this microbe, this Nissl 1917, does promote colon cancer or bowel background, right? And so now it's much safer than the strain that we're working with. It's called the NC101 strain, the PKS positive E. coli that we've been working on. So it's produces less polyps or less colon cancer than that strain, but it still does produce it above background.
Yeah, and your research is really interesting because you use animal models very effectively to kind of, you know, see the impact of a single factor. But it's also interesting because that the combination of the host genetics and their ability to counteract the DNA damage, as well as their own diet and their mucosal barrier integrity, all of these things come into play.
Yeah.
So
I guess it's a factor as well that I don't know the E. coli strain that you work on, but if that's a commensal member of the gut microbiota, then it is constantly there, constantly causing damage, while probiotics essentially pass through. They don't colonize normally, and they perhaps don't even metabolize very much as they go through. It's largely interaction through other means. And so perhaps in that way, it wouldn't actually cause as much damage as a probiotic as it would if it were a commensal.
Yeah. That's a really good point.
Alberto, what do you make of the fact that the Western diet, like the high fat and sugar diet, didn't seem to amplify the danger from this colibactin producing E. coli the way that the low fiber diet did? The low fiber diet, I think, essentially was rat chow or rodent chow that it sort of had the fiber taken out of it.
So just the, you know, we in our study, it was all animal models. We had either the normal chow diet, the low fiber, essentially almost no fiber diet, and then the Western style diet that is also reduced in fiber but is not as it still has some fiber. And one of the reasons we were interested in that diet too, because that's also linked to colon cancer development. So the original study, the motivation for the original study was, you know, we know microbes can cause cancer. We know diets can cause cancer. We thought that there might be some sort of synergy between diets and microbes. And we know that diets can modulate the abundance of specific microbes. And so that was the motivation of this study. Now, when we did that specific study with the PKS positive E. coli strain, we didn't find, first of all, that the Western style diet synergized with this microbe and caused colon cancer. And part of the reason why is we noticed that there's enough fiber in that Western style diet that the mucus layer remained thick. And I think that that was a key. We didn't fully explore that further because once we found which diet interacts with which microbe, that's the one we kind of continued. But we did find initially that the thickness of the mucus layer was similar to that of the normal chow diet.
Yeah.
Could you imagine a time in the future, Alberto, where, you know, someone might get their microbiome sequenced, find a high abundance of PKS producers, whether E. coli or others, and that, you know, clinicians would actually recommend action to reduce that number by antibiotics or by phages or whatever competitive mechanism that was used. Do you think that the role of these PKS enzymes in leading to colon cancer is strong enough, that the evidence is strong enough that action should be taken on foot of a discovery like that?
Yeah. So, and that's a really important point. There's been a lot of interest in this microbe over the last number of years. One of the first studies that suggested a causal link between this microbe and human colon cancer was published by two groups that showed, because this toxin produces a mutation signature in cell lines. So if you add this bacteria on cell lines over a period of 4 or 5 months, you start noticing these mutation signatures. So these mutation signatures are essentially mutations that occur in our sequence context. So you can identify them. And they found that same mutation signature exists in colon cancer patients. And just published last year in a Nature paper, they showed that mutation signature exists in the APC gene, which is one of the most dominantly mutated genes in colon cancer. And hence now people then said, well, then it's a driver, right? So that this toxin is now considered a driver. If they're seeing that same mutation signature in the APC gene, that means that it's probably driving the development of this cancer. Also published last year, it's a really interesting study published in Lancet, or a sister of Lancet, was showing that this microbe is geographically uneven around the world. So there's countries like North America, like Canada, where I'm at, where PKS positive E. coli infects about 20% of the population. So 20% of us have this microbe in our gut. But other countries like Pakistan, Bangladesh, have very low frequency of this microbe, right? And so, and again, there's a geographic distribution around the world. And if you measure colon cancer rates to incidence or frequency of this microbe around the world, it's almost a beautiful correlation, right? Statistically very significant correlation, suggesting that this microbe might be a major cause of colon cancer around the world. All these studies have really led a lot of individuals to really start further characterizing this microbe and how it's related to colon cancer. We've just gotten a grant proposal accepted by the Canadian Institute of Health Research to carry out some clinical trials to test whether we can, because our study was largely mouse model study, although there was some human validation, but we are now being funded to do two clinical trials. One is to assess whether a low fiber diet or a high fiber diet can modulate the abundance of this microbe in cohorts that we have in Toronto. And the other is to test, because our paper showed that mismatch repair deficient mice are highly susceptible to damage produced by Colibacterium, because mismatch repair somehow, and we don't understand that so far too, but that mismatch repair repairs the lesions produced by Colibacterium. And so, and as I mentioned, about 20 to 30% of all colon cancers are deficient in mismatch repair. We are now following, or we plan to follow, Lynch cohorts. Lynch are those individuals that have a mutation in the mismatch repair gene, to see if they're more susceptible to polyps or colon cancer produced by this microbe compared to those that do not have this mutation. So that's where we're moving towards. And I think a lot of other studies are moving towards more translational studies.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see how you guys design that, because you also showed, in addition to diet and genetic susceptibility, that the inflammatory milieu is like a key driver. And there's almost like a vicious circle in that these colobacter producing bacteria, like they can thrive in where there's inflammation and thrive on nitric oxide. And they do less well when there's the short chain fatty acids that the, you know, that are a lot of the bacteria that we root for, you know, produce. So, I'll be interested to see how you design that study to account for the diet and the amount of inflammation that the patients have.
Yeah. That's an excellent point. That's something I did not raise so far, but you're right about this nitric oxide. This bacteria thrives with inflammation. So, and that, I think that's all again stimulated by this reduced mucus layer. Once you get a reduced mucus layer, your immune system starts recognizing these microbes, not necessarily just PKS positive E. coli, but other microbes and their metabolites that they produce, and they start an inflammatory reaction. And we can see that just once you reduce a mucus layer, regardless of whether the mice have this microbe or not, you start seeing inflammation in the gut. And that inflammation leads to secretion of nitric oxide, which PKS positive E. coli uses to breathe, right?
Yeah.
And then it blooms, right? So it's a kind of a vicious circle. You're right. It's a well put term, vicious circle. And so, yeah, so we have, interestingly, a couple of, one of our cohorts that we are planning to analyze is an IBD cohort, a cohort of individuals with inflammatory bowel disease. But you're right. We're currently right now at the stage we've received the funding, and we're now currently designing exactly the two cohorts on how we propose to test these correlations.
And I'd like to go back to Dan's earlier point in your answer about why produce colobactin. I mean, obviously the bacterium doesn't care whether its host has IBD, IBS, cancer. It just wants to replicate as fast as it can. And is there a direct evidence, for example, if you create a colobactin knockout of one of these strains, that it becomes immediately significantly less competitive than its colobactin positive sister?
So that's a really good question. We did not do that specific experiment. That is actually an experiment that probably should be done. Maybe it's being done and I just don't know about it. But one thing that we did do, just to kind of emphasize a point that we think that colibacterium is there to deal with other microbes, is that if you look at the microbiome composition, right, and in a mouse that's been colonized with PKS positive E. coli versus a mouse that's been colonized with a mutant version of PKS positive E. coli that's mutated in one gene called CLBP that can't produce active colibacterium, so we'll just call it colibacterium deficient microbe, but it's just these two microbes that are missing are different by one gene. The microbiome looks different, right? And we can see some microbes going down in those mice that are infected with a PKS positive E. coli, the wild type versus the mutant. So we suspect that those microbes might be somehow more susceptible to colibacterium induced damage. But again, that's an observation that's in our paper. Mm. And you can see that observation. That requires follow-up, of course. That would be great to validate that these microbes that we see decreasing in the guts of in mice that are infected with a wild-type colibacterium strain, that those bacteria might be deficient in the current, let's say, the DNA repair pathways that would normally repair the lesions produced by that. But that requires a follow-up study.
And is it overly simplistic to imagine that you could perhaps immunize people against colibacterium or again, get them to produce antibodies to negate the production of colibacterium?
It's possible, yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty confident that a lot of individuals, a lot of research groups are trying to develop therapeutics against this bacteria. We're actually working with somebody, a group in California, where they have this interesting approach to try to reduce this microbe in the guts of individuals. So I'm not at liberty of saying what it is, but I'm sure there's a lot of groups around the world that are trying to therapeutically treat these microbes. I think for us, the easiest is just make sure you have a high fiber diet. That's kind of what our data is suggesting, you know? And that's
people always seem to prefer a shortcut. People to change their diet is almost the most difficult thing to get someone to do. Getting a drug is relatively simple in comparison.
Well, Professor Martin, your studies are beautiful, like how they explore mechanism. I'm wondering, are there any mechanisms that we haven't touched on that have been intriguing you? You've been working in this field for over a decade and made a lot of groundbreaking discoveries.
Yeah, no, I think the mechanisms that we discussed are the main ones that I'd say are important to raise. In our current research efforts, as I mentioned earlier, is to test whether these other PKS positive strains of microbes, whether they produce colon cancer. And our preliminary data suggests that they do, but at reduced frequency or the induction of cancer is reduced compared to the NC101 strain. But that's currently what we're working on. That we are also working with other therapeutics because this microbe requires nitrate to breathe, and there are ways to inhibit that in this bacteria, so we're testing whether that can be another, let's say, angle to reduce pathogenesis caused by this microbe.
Yeah, these are really beautiful insights. I mean, it's It's extraordinary, really. It's a smoking gun in one sense that all microbiome science is looking for, going from associations to mechanism to validation in humans. You know, I wish every microbiome-associated disease was on the same kind of track, because it offers so much promise, maybe, in potential therapeutics for preventing, hopefully preventing rather than treating gastric cancers.
Yeah.
Alberto, we've run out of time already. It was just so fascinating talking to you. So thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of your insights in this fascinating field.
Yeah, thank you. It was really a pleasure to speak to both of you, and hopefully other people find this work interesting.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org, and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.